parts. Well, remember what we're looking at is the church in the later Middle Ages, and we want to begin looking for those things which are precursors to the Protestant Reformation. Some of the reasons why things got in such a fix that such a thing as the Protestant Reformation could take place. We've been looking at the Great Schism, where you end up with three popes, and we have traced how they had three popes. The famous Council of Constance, which we're going to look at again, named because it was held here in the city name for Constans, but it's not on this map, it's in the Southern Holy Roman Empire. The Council of Constance was called to settle this schism, and it did so. It found John the 23rd, as I said yesterday, John the 23rd was accused of 70 different crimes, most of which he was guilty, and deposed. And the reason that the Pope in modern times, who was Pope in the 50s, was called John the 23rd, was that the Roman Catholic Church was announcing that this John the 23rd didn't count. He was not in the succession. Gregory, the Roman Pope, voluntarily resigned. He had sense enough to see what was happening. Benedict the 13th, the Avignon Pope at this time, he was deposed. He didn't recognize his deposition, but it didn't make any difference because the cardinals isolated him. He was a pope with nothing to pope over. He didn't officially recognize his deposition. He just went out of business because nobody paid attention to him. It's hard to be a pope when nobody will pay attention to you. This left Martin V, who was elected by the Council of Constance. And interestingly enough, as soon as he was elected, Martin refused to recognize the authority of the councils over the pope. Well, the council's authority over the pope is what gave him his office. We'll talk about that in a minute. But he didn't. I'll just mention it here. He did not recognize conciliar precedence. That's the real question. Who has precedence? Who has authority? The council or the popes? Yes.
Urban the sixth, and who are you asking now? Page 150.
Yes.
Urban the sixth, but he's not listening on the parenthetical
summary
or on page
26.
You know, I thought it was settled. You know what I mean?
Martin the fifth, you mean?
Okay, but there's another guy called Urban the sixth. Bottom of page 150.
Yes, but that was before you had three. That's when you only had two. That's why it doesn't appear. Okay. You understand what he's asking? In other words, the schism was, well, I only listed all when you had all three. What else did the council of Constance decide? They undertook some minor reforms, that is, moral and administrative reforms, took some action. They burned John Huss. We're going to talk about that later. They set a schedule for future councils, but they ran into trouble. I'm not going to discuss the Council of Basel, which was held in 1433. It was very complicated, but what happened was that in the Council of Basel, the council lost out, and the Pope, who was Eugene IV, won out in this struggle of the supremacy of the council vis-a-vis the Pope. Now, let me move down to summarize. You can read about the Council of Basel and how it figured in. But let me summarize 153, the results of the conciliar movement. By the way, you might want to be reading ahead because we're going to be moving rather quickly now for these last discussions. But you will be responsible for all the readings that are assigned, even though we might cover more than one discussion a day. I will not necessarily hold you responsible on that day, but you will be responsible by the end of the quarter. Having all your readings done. What were the results? Well, first of all, I note that by ending the Great Schism and uniting the church under one pontiff, the conciliar movement dug its own grave. Just like with Martin V, once you had one strong central pope again, in other words, the councils ended this mess of having three competing popes and gave one strong central pope. It could do that because it claimed authority over the papacy. And what did this one strong central pope do? Immediately reasserted the authority of the papacy over the councils. So in that, you can see the conciliar movement, the movement to have councils with authority over the popes, dug its own grave. I mean, they created a strong pope, and he just turned right around and denied the authority of the councils, the very authority which had established is supremacy. Secondly, the blending of reform. The point here is that one of the reasons that the Protestant Reformation was that the church was so badly in need of moral and administrative reform. Well, one of the reasons, but was there any concern to reform the church? We're talking about all these money-grubbing techniques and all the buying of office, all the simony and all the terrible problems. Yes, there was a great deal of concern about this. But the problem was that it was tied to the conciliar movement. Like the Council of Constance established one pope where there were finally three, but it also called for moral and administrative reform. But when the conciliar movement failed, the movement for that kind of reform failed with it because they were tied together. It was like a rider on a bill. Y'all see that? So that, and historians generally agree that if the conciliar movement had succeeded, accompanying desire for moral and administrative reform would have gone further, and it's possible there might not have been a Protestant Reformation, at least in the form in which it took. See, that's a good point to remember for a test. This is one of the reasons there was little, if any, moral and administrative reform at this time, even though there was a great deal of desire for it. And it eventually, this desire is one of the key elements in the Protestant Reformation. You see that? There could have been significant reform back here, but it was tied to the conciliar movement, and the Pope squelched that. Third, and this is very important, it became clear to thinking people, including the reformers who were to come, that there was little hope for reforming the church and the papacy. One of the reasons the Protestant Reformation was so powerful was that people began to see that reform is going to have to come from without. It isn't going to come from within. What would lead them to conclude it was not going to come from within? Answer, the failure of the conciliar movement. There was a great attempt to bring about this. In other words, some of the very reforms that the Protestants called for were the same reforms that those that the cardinals were calling for and trying to bring about by giving the councils control over the church. When the councils didn't get this control, this didn't happen. And so the people said, well, so when Luther and Calvin come along and say we're going to reform from without, people were willing to listen because they had seen the failure of the church to reform from within. Does that make sense to you? Kind of summarizing, but it helps us understand what's going on. We're going to look very briefly at the popes of the Italian Renaissance, and this is important because this is the papacy in the 100 years leading up to the Protestant Reformation. Another reason why the Reformation worked to the degree that it did work, and this reason is tied to the failure of the conciliar movement, was that the popes they got, not only did the councils fail to assert their authority over the papacy and bring about this reform, the popes that they had in the following 100 years, one of the 100 years leading up to the Reformation, were lousy. Some of the worst popes in the history of the church, the popes of the Italian Renaissance. Here you had men who were about as far away from being spiritual leaders as anybody you could possibly imagine. The Pope was just one more competing Italian prince in northern Italy in these series of city-states. I summarized the papacy of the Italian Renaissance. You understand what I'm talking about now, the popes they had leading up to the Reformation? They functioned primarily as civil rulers. They were patrons of the Renaissance. That is, they were more interested in literature and art and classical pagan tradition. We're going to talk about the Renaissance later, and you'll know more about that, but simply say the popes, rather than their first concern being for the church, it was for culture, society, for the Renaissance. They were indulgent fathers and uncles who were given to legitimizing their children and caring for them by giving them offices in the church. They were shrewd financiers. And we've already mentioned how the fact that the drain on gold from these emerging nations encouraged these kings to support the Reformation. We'll see that next quarter. Many of the popes in this period were shameless profligates. What's a profligate? Is without morals, without ethical restraints. And I give an example. The nadir of the Renaissance papacy was Alexander VI, probably the worst pope the church ever had. Probably. He bought the papacy for first of all, but that wasn't so bad. That was the custom of the time. You buy the papacy. But he was of the famous family Borgia. The Borgia, and you can read about the Borgias. They were very exceedingly wicked people. They had a very good reputation. He was a Borgia pope. This is a northern Italian family. Schaff writes of Alexander, and I take time to read Schaff now because I want us to sort of capture the spirit of the Renaissance papacy to help us understand how this could lead to a reformation from without. The prominent features of Alexander's career as the supreme pontiff of Christendom were his dissolute habits and his extravagant passion to exalt the worldly fortunes of his children. The gaieties, escapades, marriages, worldly distinctions and crimes of these children would have furnished daily material for paragraphs of a nature to satisfy the most sensational modern taste. That which marks him out for unmitigated condemnation is his lack of principle. Mental ability, which is ascribed to the devil himself, is no substitute for moral qualities. Perfidy, treachery, greed, lust, and murder were stored up in Alexander's heart. He shrank from the commission of no crime to reach the objects of his ambition. He was wont to engage in the solemn exercises of devotion, even to saying the Mass with his own lips. To measure his iniquity, as has been said, one need only compare his actions with the simple statement of the precepts, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal. That is, he just believed the opposite of all this. Elevation to position of responsibility usually has the effect of sobering a man's spirit. But Rodrigo Borgia, who was Alexander VI, degraded the highest office and the gift of Christendom for his own carnal designs. That means scheming, untrustworthiness, plotting for his own ends. Now, Leo X, we're going to meet again. He was the Renaissance Pope who was ruling when Martin Luther did his reforming work, when Martin Luther began the Reformation in Germany. Now, he was one of the best of the Renaissance popes. I give you the years here, 1513 and following. But he was an Italian gentleman. He knew little of Christian piety. So they weren't all as bad as Alexander VI. But once the schism was over and the popes could once again assert their absolute authority, then there followed a series of popes who were very, very, very bad popes. Called the popes of the Italian Renaissance. They were worldly, secular. Some of them were hideous in their immorality, open immorality. And they created a situation in Rome that when Martin Luther went, he really took the wind out of his sails. The dream of his life, to go to Rome. And he goes to Rome, what does he find? He finds a den of thieves. He finds a moral pig pen. And this had a good influence on Martin Luther. Okay? Now we look to the doctrine of the church, and I want to not spend much time in discussion 30. Let me summarize for you scholasticism. Let's look down on page 155 of our syllabus. You can read over the doctrine of the church, the period of the rise of schools and universities. This begin to see these as the Renaissance begins to take shape. But there was a movement that we must understand something about in Roman Catholicism because it, again, was preparatory to the Reformation, the rise of scholasticism. Look at the, first of all, number B3, the rise of early scholasticism. It arose in this as a part of a movement towards schools other than just in the monasteries. It arose it was an attempt to apply the principles of Aristotle to theology. It was a reaction to Muslim scholarship. Let me summarize this way, and this you can look away from your syllabus. I've got the details there. What was happening was that Muslim scholarship was Aristotelian. They argued from reason to faith. In other words, you believe what you believe because it's reasonable, which is what we would accept. The Roman Catholic Church was actually practicing was a belief based purely upon authority. It is true because the church says it is true. Well, what was happening was in open debate, in discussion, in the world of learning, especially as the Renaissance is coming on, the Muslim scholars are blowing away the Christian scholar, the Roman Catholic Church. And so what scholasticism was an attempt not to question whether or not what the Roman Catholic Church was teaching was true or not, but to show that it could be true. They would say, we believe it because the church says it, but it is rational. Now, the basic reason, in my opinion, that scholasticism broke down as a movement was that because it started with a system that could not be defended rationally. The system was based upon Augustinianism, which defied reason. And so, and Thomas Aquinas, the greatest of the scholastics, found this out, that you could only go so far, and pretty soon, try as you might, and they got into intricate designs. You can read the works of Thomas Aquinas. It's like reading the Talmud. They tried their best to show that what the Roman Catholic Church was teaching was reasonable. Following? Not as the basis of belief, but just as an auxiliary statement. But they couldn't do it for the simple reason that it had an Augustinian base, and for that and other reasons, it was not reasonable. So eventually you had to fall back on authority. Okay? There was no attempt to gain new knowledge, no attempt to question what the church was teaching. And some of the early schoolmen on page 156, and I'm not going to get into this rather complicated discussion here because of time, but we run across names as Anselm, the greatest of the schoolmen, Peter Abelard, a powerful teacher at the University of Paris, Peter Lombard. These are all names associated with scholasticism. They're developed out of the early scholasticism, page 157 of our syllabus now. High scholasticism, grew up in the universities. Representatives of the higher or later scholasticism, Duns Scotus, Albert Magnus, Bonaventura, and the greatest of them all, Thomas Aquinas, 1225 to 1274. Thomas Aquinas, the leading representative of advanced or high scholasticism, had such an effect that Roman Catholic theology today is that of Thomas Aquinas, as he sort of codified it, explained it. In fact, it is called Thomism, after Thomas Aquinas. Thomism is Roman Catholic theology. And I list here an outline of Thomism. Now what this is, note this, this is, what Thomism is a quasi-rational explanation. It is a systematic theology explaining and defending what the church was already teaching. Got that? I say quasi-rational because, as a matter of fact, it did not work. You got that? So you have a systematic theology, a theological presentation of the theology of the medieval Roman Catholic Church. It was so thoroughly done that it fixed it. And so that is why the theology of the Roman Catholic Church today is essentially the same as it was when Thomas Aquinas got through defining it. Some of it was not official yet, had not become official dogma, but it was essentially fixed. You see that? Okay, it's a different. You read over your syllabus carefully, and of course you have this also in your reading in Laterette. So between what I say and your syllabus in Laterette, you should get a pretty good idea of what you're looking at when you look at scholasticism. By the way, an outline of it, the seat of authority is revelation through the church. The task of reason is to demonstrate so far as it can that revelation is reasonable. And this is still the theory of the Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Catholic Church still says that revelation is reasonable, but at least most of the time, it is not founded on reason, it is founded on authority. It is true not because it makes sense, it is true because of what? And because the Bible says it, it is true because the church says it's true. Secondly, God, he reaffirmed the orthodox doctrine of the Trinity as set forth in the Chalcedonian Creed. He settled on the cosmological, teleological argument for God as opposed to the ontological argument. And you can study into that. That is the argument from cause and effect. He settled upon predestination, Augustinian double election. He took the Augustine view of man up to a point. Well, I mean, I'm sorry, he took the Augustine view of man, but it was on this point, interestingly enough, now this is very important, Aquinas sided with Augustine. Aquinas, the schoolman or the representative of high scholasticism, he sided with Augustine. He went back and simply restated what Augustine said about man, Augustine anthropology, total depravity, and all that went with it. Interestingly enough, on this single point, the church is not Thomistic. This is quite a thing. The church departed, they said, Aquinas is wrong on this point, Augustine anthropology, and the church sided with Duns Scotus, who I mentioned up here. Duns Scotus said that Duns Scotus held for a seriously modified Augustinianism, and because the church sided with Duns Scotus on this one point, not with Thomas Aquinas, it opposed Luther and Calvin when they affirmed Augustine. Interestingly enough, on anthropology, Aquinas and Luther and Calvin were essentially in agreement. The view of man. One of the reasons that Aquinas departed from Augustine on some other serious things. It's quite an interesting and quite complicated situation. Concerning salvation, Aquinas says that God is the source of grace. He provides the channel or vehicle of grace. It is the sacraments. Man's part is faith. That is, acceptance of Christ as clothed in church doctrine. The Christ you accept is the Christ of church doctrine. Plus man's part, man also has to do works. Obedience to the commands of the church, which obedience produces merit, which may achieve the level of supererogation. And of course, Luther and Calvin objected to this. Concerning sin, Aquinas, on page 158 now, he defined venial sin, which resulted in temporary punishment in purgatory, mortal sin, which would send you to hell. Then the sacraments, we're going to discuss later, the seven sacraments. As far as their value was concerned, they were channels by which divine grace, which was an active moral force, is infused. The method, now look this, and you're going to have to know this, know what these terms mean, ex opere operato. Now here, it was an important, work of Thomas Aquinas regarding the sacraments. Not only was the number fixed at seven, but the theory was set forth of ex opere operato. Now the church had been more or less practicing this. Now it becomes fixed. What is ex opere operato? It, literally from the Latin, it means from the work, the work. From the work, the work. What it means is that the sacraments are efficacious if they are properly administered. That is, for instance, it does not require faith or anything else on the part of the person who's receiving them. For instance, when is a baptism efficacious? When does it take? When is it the real thing? According to ex opere operato, it is efficacious when it is performed by a properly ordained person, using properly sanctified elements, water, and using the right, the authorized liturgy, the right words. You got that? The right person, the right element, the right words. If it's done in an authorized way by an authorized person, it is efficacious. By the way, that's why, for instance, in the period of the Spanish conquest of South America, Central America, they could line up the natives and baptize them and declare them Christians. You didn't have the foggiest notion what was going on, but it was efficacious. Why? You had officially ordained priests doing it in the authorized way. You see that? So it is. That is the theory that the sacraments are efficacious because if they are done right. Whereas we would say that, well, for instance, using baptism, what makes baptism efficacious?
did you say the right words? Is there a baptismal formula in the Bible? There's no baptismal formula. What has to be said? If the one doing the baptism, if he is properly ordained, does the Bible say, you know, who has to do it? No, we would say that baptism is efficacious only insofar as you have a person who understands and who is genuinely repentant, right? And the water can be any water, and the person who does it, that doesn't have to be anything in particular, doesn't have to be a clergyman, and doesn't have to say anything. See? That which it makes it baptism efficacious is the faith of the candidate. See that? Where they just turned this around and said, no, ex opere operato, the virtue of the sacraments in and of themselves. Do you see what that means? From the work, the work. That is, it is efficacious from the way it's done right. Any questions on that? I expect you to know that. That's sure to be on the test, I promise you. Know what ex opere operato is. But the Roman Catholic Church still practices it. Remember one time, first time I ever saw this, I was early in the hospital. I was a kid when I got out of high school before I even started Bible college. And a man brought a man in who had died in a motorcycle accident and had been dead for some time. And the priest came in and administered last rites, which you're not supposed to do unless the person is still alive. But they did anyway. So he had the phrase, and, you know, here's this corpse lying there, and he's going at it. He's got his oil on his thumb, and he's saying all the Latin. And went through the whole thing, you know, and just to get through it, you see. And because the fellow was obviously dead, been dead for some time. So he just went through there and said, you know, blah, 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 and through the whole thing. And then we went out and assured the family that it was efficacious, you know, that he had received the sacrament, and they didn't have to worry. Why? Well, you see, he was ordained, and he had the right properly blessed oil, and he said the right words. Yes. With the right elements, elements involved. What makes the Lord's Supper efficacious, you see? We would say, if your heart's not in it, don't bother taking the emblems. Ex opere operato says, if it's properly served in prescribed way, according to authorized liturgy, it's the Lord's Supper, it's efficacious. Well, see, what makes it the Lord's Supper? What makes it real communion? Okay. Let me ask you this. If you take the loaf and the cup next time it's past Sunday, and you don't consider yourself, you don't consider the church, you're just thinking about something altogether out in left field. Have you had the Lord's Supper? No, you've had some unleavened bread and fruit of the vine, right? It has not been the Lord's Supper at all. Well, that's just the opposite of that. It is the Lord's Supper no matter what you're thinking. It's been made so by the operation of the clergy. That helped. Did y'all see that? Question. No, it's not totally disregarded. But they would call for faith, say, in baptism, and they would call for devotion in the Lord's Supper. They call for that. But that's not what makes it efficacious. What I'm saying is, they would, well, oh yes, don't misunderstand me. They ex opere operato. Ex opere operato does not discourage faith in that sense. Does not say you don't have to have it. It calls for it. But the point that makes it ex opere operato is that the efficacy of the sacrament does not depend upon it. You understand that? It does not depend upon it. We want you to have a devotional response. But even if you don't, it's still efficacious. It's a good question. Okay, now we come to discussion 31, and you have not done the reading for this yet, but I'm going to move into it very quickly. We look at the seven sacraments, and I think we ought to take a little bit of time on this, as they became fixed at this time. We must look at this because we want to see this was the context for the Protestant Reformation. You understand how it's fixed now? Through Thomism. See, Thomas, listen to me. Thomas, you understand what I'm saying, don't you? Thomas did not think up these doctrines. He simply explained them in such a complicated way that they became more or less fixed. Baptism, first of all, first of the seven sacraments. Baby is born with a sinful nature and bears the fruit of Adam's guilt. Baptism regenerates his nature, remits Adam's sin, and plants the seed of faith. The baby's not baptized. We discussed this in eschatology class. It goes to limbus infantum for eternity. That is, limbus infantum or limbo. He does not suffer. An unbaptized child does not go to hell to suffer for eternity. He just has a limbo, a place of general happiness, but where God is absent. For this reason, baptism may be performed by a lay person in an emergency situation. So this is the statement on infant baptism. You got that? By the way, this idea that implants the seed of faith, this is Plato. Plato believed, in reincarnation, believed that every child is born with all knowledge. Education, therefore, means just to draw it out, to remind him that he know already of what he already knows. That's what the word education means, by the way, to draw out. And therefore, in the Catholic theory, when a baby is baptized, not all knowledge, but religious knowledge, spiritual knowledge, faith, is infused in the child, and then the purpose of education is to draw it out, to make the child know that this has been implanted in him. That's where we got our word education, from the Roman Catholic world, which says education is to draw out this knowledge which was infused at baptism. Yes? He had levels of hell because of different kind of people, I recall, Dante.
Right.
Yeah. But did he mention limbo? Right. Yeah. Oh, yes, this is standard doctrine.
Standard doctrine.
I'm sorry? Perhaps. Well, it wasn't dogma. It was just suggested that righteous pagans were also in limbo. But it wasn't not dogma, was they were in hell. So you have baptism, you have confirmation, and of course it is sprinkling now by a priest. Confirmation, at least was most of the time. It was a rite which gave another dose of grace after baptism. It was to come as soon as possible after baptism in the early Middle Ages. In the later Middle Ages, it came in early adolescence. It served to confirm the faith implanted at baptism, to give the emerging adult the increased inner moral power to live up to the Christian standards. This was a very immoral time, I've said. So whereas confirmation was originally given early, it came to be later. They would wait till the child was going through puberty, facing all the challenges of his sexuality. And they thought that was a good time to give him another dose of the Spirit to help him through this time. So confirmation was moved to then. I don't know if it worked or not, but that was a part of the reason. Does that make sense to you? You understand that grace is an infused moral force, so it's obvious they needed some more grace infused in some of the people in that day. So that's what confirmation was. Penance. The four elements of penance, according to Thomas Aquinas, were contrition. You had to be sorry for your sins. Confession to a priest. The failure to confess at least once a year is a mortal sin. Absolution. This remits the guilt. The priest says, absolvo te, I absolve you. And then satisfaction. This deals with the temporal penalty for sin, a penalty which must be paid either in this life or in purgatory. But according to Thomas Aquinas, this is the way it was. Contrition, confession, absolution, satisfaction. This takes care of only a, by the way, what you paid in this life could only take a part of, could only pay a part of the purgatorial suffering. The theory was that everybody went to purgatory, at least for a little while, with the exception of the saints. Only the saints. They had more than enough. Not only did they not owe any penalty, they had money in the bank. That's what a saint was. It's worked of supererogation. Supererogation meant not only did they not die in debt, they died with a surplus. You died in debt as far as satisfaction is concerned, therefore you had to go to purgatory. Now, if you paid money and had prayers said and did work, good works and various things, you could detract from your debt. But everybody died at least a little bit in debt. Everybody got at least singed. Except the saints, who died with a surplus and And one of the ways you could shorten your account was to draw upon their surplus. The Treasury of Merit, it's called. The indulgence is a purchased... Look, by the way, learn what an indulgence is. I'm going to question you on that, because this is the... We find Martin Luther objecting to indulgences. We recall that indulgences became more important during the Crusades. They were offered as incentives to go and free the Holy Land from the infidel by the Pope. The indulgence is a purchased substitute for acts of satisfaction or penance, which draws upon the supererogative or excess of meritorious work stored in the treasury of the saints. That is, the indulgence was you could either do an act of satisfaction, or you could write a check on the surplus in the treasury of the saints. You got that? Is you could either do it yourself, or you could pay so much, and then some of their good works would apply to you, which would help to pay your debt of satisfaction for sins already forgiven. See, it's not forgiveness now. You're not buying forgiveness. You only pay satisfaction. You only buy indulgences to help ease your debt for sins forgiven. You got that? Do not purchase forgiveness. Follow me? You have to be absolved of them first before you even pay the penalty. You understand that now? It's very important. That the Eucharist or the Lord's Supper it is divided up into the communion. First of all, look at the communion. The worshiper partook of the bread only. In the Mass, the priest reoffers the body of Christ, performs the miracle of transubstantiation, and partakes of both bread and wine. So you have the Mass kind of spoken of as different from the communion, two aspects of the Eucharist. What is the value of the Eucharist to one who attends? Number one, the worshiper receives a new attrition or measure of grace, another dose of power to help you live the Christian life. Yes? Yeah, we talk about this, that the idea that the communion is something of a re-baptism or a mini-baptism. Yeah, very far. It comes from the same kind of thinking. I don't know where these particular preachers get it. But it's out of a new infusion of grace, a little more dose of grace to help you have moral power, inner moral power. By the way, this is a good holiness doctrine, too. It's the same kind of thing. Secondly, so that he gets a new measure of grace, new infusation of grace. Secondly, the communicant receives absolution. The absence of the Christian from the Eucharist is a mortal sin. He has to commune at least once a year. And the presence of the Christian has the effect of absolution, not complete absolution. But the more you go to communion, you only have to go once a year, or it's a mortal sin. You know that? You only have to go once a year, or it's a mortal sin. But if you, the more you go, in other words, the more time you spend in church, the less time you spend in purgatory. Simple as that. Yes, it has the same effect as penance. Right. Masses can be set at a price for the dead to decrease their time in purgatory. You got your mother, your father died, and they died pretty much in debt. They didn't live a very good life. You could have masses said, which would apply to the dead just as they apply to the living. Follow me? The mass could have the same effect. As you went to mass, it could decrease your time in purgatory, have the effect of absolution. But by paying money, it could have the same effect on a loved one who was already dead. Well, you go to Roman Catholic Church, by the way, and see candles lit during the Mass. People will pay so much to have a candle lit during the Mass. So this applies to them. Right? Have a Mass said for somebody. Anybody here raise Roman Catholic besides them? This is true. That's what it means. Have a Mass said for somebody. Yeah, drop the money and light the candle. This Mass applies to them. As this is if they were here. Yes.
Believing to children in private Christian church who lead in
good question. I would say that the use of candles, especially with children, if you had somebody, you know, who would really make this association, I think you'd be better off without it. But like so many other things, if there was nobody there who made this association, I wouldn't worry about it. Usually we use candles in church at Christmas, but at no other time. But if the use of candles, you know, were to really cause somebody to, somebody was new, you know, just be a matter of common sense. But I wouldn't say it was a problem in and of itself. I wouldn't discount the use just on that grounds, if it didn't really bother anybody. Just find out who's present. Yeah.
Also, too, if I remember right, in the Catholic church that I went to, they had one set of candles in front of the statue of Jesus and the other one in front of the statue of
You have prayers said, you know, they represent prayers being said in some sense. Thomas Aquinas worked out the explanation of transubstantiation before it had been more or less undefined, which describes the substance of the wine and bread versus the accidents, and this is the explanation still used today, that the substance means what it is spiritually, the accidents what it is physically. And the reality exists in the substance, not the accident. By the way, they use substance the opposite way. We would use the word substance. Got that? We say substance, we mean the physical stuff, the wine, the bread. They say substance, they mean the historical, mystical body of Christ. And the elements, then, so their reality exists not in their accidents, but in their substance, that is, in reality, the elements become the body and blood of Christ, the historical body and blood of Christ, that and nothing else. You see that? The accidents would be what left over. The accidents is what the loaf and the cup would be if you took them to the laboratory and analyzed them after the miracle of the Mass was performed. But that's not what they really are. They can be, that is, the Roman Catholic explanation. If you say, but they really aren't the body and blood of Christ and nothing else. The answer is, as I understand it, well, they are only wine and bread in their accidents, in their substance. They are the body and blood of Christ, that and nothing else. And the reality, and what they really are is what they are in substance. By that they mean what they're transubstantiated into. Follow me? See the word transubstantiation? Transubstance? Follow me? Okay. Anyway, it's quite complicated. Extreme unction based upon James 5, 14 and 15, I think a misunderstanding of that. Extreme unction is not done in the case of ordinary sickness, but extreme sickness, which appears to be leading to immediate death, although not for all, in actual practice, the Roman Catholic Church uses it on those who are dead. When John Kennedy, for instance, was killed, the priest went in, he was already dead. He was dead when they rolled him into the hospital. Dead for a long time. They didn't announce it. They did not announce his death until the priest had time to be there. The priest went in and performed extreme unction on the dead body of John Kennedy. The priest came out and assured the family that the soul had not left the body yet. The soul stayed around for that service. And then they announced his death. But when they announced his death, he'd been dead for quite a while. Did you know that, by the way? And the priest came out and assured the family that he was not really gone yet. Why? Because, you see, he might have gone out into eternity with sins not yet taken care of. Pardon? My own memory. I was watching the TV. It had TV coverage. Yeah. What they had the all-day coverage, and then they showed the hospital in Dallas, and I read various articles on it. I don't have it documented. It doesn't have to be. That's just an example. The anointing with special oil of various parts of the body accomplishes three things. It may help the sick to recover, according to the theory of extreme unction. It offers psychological or spiritual encouragement in the face of death, and it remits the remnants of sin so far as the church can perform that function. It will keep the believer out of hell, but not out of purgatory. See, the reason they're so much concerned to have extreme unction, the reason the Roman Catholic Church often finds itself performing extreme unction on those who die before the priest could get there is especially in the case of accidents or murders, because if the extreme unction is not, in this very legalistic system, if the unction is not performed before the spirit leaves the body, then the possibility exists that this person might have gone out into eternity with unforgiven sins. Got that? Unforgiven sins. And so, do them with that. Now, it doesn't mean that the case is hopeless. If they do, the church can